Buddhist Summer School, Saturday afternoon, 29th August 1981. Possibly, those who are earnest about living the Buddhist life may have the practice of taking pansil every day, the invocation, as we call it. And it starts off, Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Now it is very easy to get into a habit and just repeat those words, like millions of people in the world repeat the words of their daily prayers without paying full attention to the significance and the implications of the words which they use. Now, the words of scripture, of all the scriptures which have come down to us through the centuries, really have to be said and thought of with complete attention. If one's attention wanders, then the words are of no avail. The Buddha, time and again, shows that those who mumbled the words of the Veda, and especially those who did it professionally for personal gain, money and goods and so on, were the very opposite of religious people. So I think it would be rather useful if we considered together the meaning and significance of this phrase, of this sentence. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. The word namo literally means homage or veneration. We have, for instance, in Vedic, namas. In the Avastan language, we have namo. The Zarathustrian scriptures, the original ones, are in Avastan. And Greek has nemos, Latin nemus. They're all the same word, meaning the same thing, homage or veneration. Now, what is our conception of homage? We know how from medieval times in this country, in Europe generally, homage was paid by the knights to the liege lord, the sovereign, and by those who worked for the knight, to the knight himself. They paid homage. And homage meant a giving of oneself to the liege lord. What sort of a giving was this giving? This is very important. It was an unconditional and an unreserved giving. And if it was that, and if it was a total and complete giving of self, it meant the complete relinquishment of self, utter selflessness. That's what it meant. And if this were the case, that the person unreservedly, unconditionally gave himself to his lord or master or whoever it was, then that was perhaps the greatest possible expression of love that man is capable of. This total giving of self to the other, unreservedly, unconditionally. If husbands and wives, for instance, could do that, would there be any trouble between them, ever? Try and feel this sort of thing out very, very deeply. Feel it intensely, this total giving up of self and all that self and selfness stands for. And if the perfect selflessness is realized, it means that love in its perfection, in its supreme aspect, is manifest in the world. And if a person is capable of that, he is also capable of being wise. You know how we have the phrase, love makes wise. That state of love enables one to see deeply and clearly the truth, the fact. And therefore, love and wisdom really go together in this act of homage. Namo, it's the homage, the veneration paid to the teacher. In this case, to the teacher, of course. Now contrast that sort of giving with the kind of giving we find mentioned by Jesus when he says, unto Caesar render what is Caesar's, but unto God render what is God's. And if we understand by the word God what they have understood in previous centuries, in a greater degree than they understand today, God not as a separate entity other than ourselves, but as the total being. And you will find this idea, I think, brought out in the philosophy of Spinoza. He is one amongst a few Western philosophers who has presented that view of God. Eckhart was another. He was, of course, a great mystic. And so, if you bear in mind God in that sense, then the giving unto God is a total self-giving. Unto Caesar, what is Caesar's? A penny. Not the old penny, the modern new pence. But unto God, the totality of oneself. Now, when I say the totality of oneself, that phrase also implies the totality of everything that is. What is oneself in reality? In reality, oneself is the total cosmos at the same time, just as the total cosmos is totally embodied in each and every single self, as we call it, in the world. This is something which has to be realized in the deeps of consciousness. Logically, it sounds absurd. Of course, it is absurd logically. But the absurdity of human logic may be, in actual fact, in actual reality, sometimes, not all times, but sometimes, divine wisdom. Now, one can see that there is a serious responsibility involved in this homage unto the teacher, in pledging oneself to the Supreme. Now, in this case, it is to him, Siddhartha Gautama, who became the Buddha, who was called Bhagavato. Bhagavato, Bhagavan, really, Bhagava and Sanskrit Bhagavan, the blessed or exalted one, the blessed one, And if you recall how the word blessed is used in the Old Testament and by Judaism, God is the Blessed One. And you remember how before the crucifixion, Caiaphas asks Jesus, "Art thou the Son of the Blessed?" They wouldn't use the name Yahweh as such. They would use names like Adonai, Elohim, and so on, but they wouldn't pronounce the holy name itself, Yahweh. And they always said, "The Blessed One." And Jesus said, "Yes," and that was a supreme blasphemy for the Jews, to say that he was the Son of the Holy One. But it means for us in India, it means the Blessed or Exalted One. One of the deities of the Rig Veda is called Bhaga, meaning the dispenser, he who gives, God the giver. And the Buddha is called the giver of the deathless by one of his great disciples, Kachana the Great, Mahakachana as he is called. I'll read you this little passage in which his words are given. It's in the first volume of the Majjhima Nikaya, the original Pali, page 111. In this translation, page 144. The people ask Kachana to talk in detail on some subject which the Buddha presented in very briefly. And Kachana says, "But, your reverences, the Lord knows what should be known, sees what should be seen. He has become vision, become knowledge, become Dhamma, become Brahma. He is the propounder, the expounder, the bringer to the goal, the giver of the deathless, Dhamma Lord, Tathagata." Of course, one reads those superlatives and one tends to just pass on, not very thoughtfully. But look carefully into that. The Lord knows what should be known. One of the implications there is that there is an aspect of knowledge, maybe many aspects of knowledge, which are not of importance, they are unnecessary. And some which the Buddha positively said should be completely out of one's life. Gossip, malicious talk, idle talk, frivolous talk, and so forth. If you read the Brahmajala Sutta, one of the long discourses, carefully, you will find page after page expounding what is to be discarded, to be taken notice of. So there is that aspect of knowledge which should be known. He sees what should be seen. Now the word "see," when applied to a perfected holy one, has an immensely deeper significance than that word has for us. We see only in so far as we are clean-minded, pure-minded, and clean-sighted, clear-sighted. And if we look into our own selves and our own lives, we are not particularly developed along those lines. When I say we, I'm not referring specifically to all of any or all of you who are very serious practitioners of the Buddha Dhamma, but mankind generally is very purblind. He sees what should be seen, and that seeing, remember, is not merely in terms of conceptualizing, accurate logical thinking, as we understand accurate logical thinking. It is immensely deeper than that. It is a sensitivity of the deep layers of the mind. And those deep layers of the mind function in us only when the psyche is completely pure, is empty. We talk about the purification of the mind, and as a matter of fact, the Buddha also uses the same phrase, purify the mind. Now, this is not very enlightening. None of us have a mind, not one. We have a psyche. What is the difference between psyche and mind? Mind is an archetypal cosmic energy which is characterless. It has no characteristics at all. It is a purely creative energy. That creative energy, I'll talk a little more about this tomorrow, coming in touch with corporeality, which is also universal. The body of the cosmos is corporeal. Coming in touch with that, with corporeality, and especially our sort of corporeality, the human body, gives rise to psyche. You know, the word psyche was introduced by the Greeks. There is no proper word for psyche in original Pali or Sanskrit, as far as I'm aware. Please correct me if I'm wrong. Any Pali scholars here who know the word? Well, I don't know any word for psyche in Pali, you see. So, when this energy comes in touch with the body and affects, interacts with the body, then it gives rise to the psyche. And it gives rise to the psyche specifically because of the interaction of this energy, which we may call mind, with the brain and nervous system, with the ductless glands, and all those factors in the body which are responsible for life and growth and so forth. It affects the whole body, actually. Even every single cell of the body has a sort of an natural intelligence about it. You will find this brought out very nicely by the late Sir Charles Sherrington in his book, Man on His Nature. I think it's in chapter 9. You study that very carefully. I'm not sure about the number of the chapter, but it's somewhere there. You will find him bringing this thing out, you see. That even the cell has the capacity to learn. And if there is the capacity to learn, there must be some sort of sensitivity which corresponds to our power to observe and understand and so forth. So, this cosmic, universal energy called mind interacting with the body gives rise to your psyche. Now, psyche is yours just as much as your arm or your head or anything else is yours. And you may talk of my psyche quite legitimately, but not my mind. What we commonly call my mind are all the flaws in the psyche, the obstructions, the misperceptions, the absurd emotions, and all the rest of it, which block the psyche. So when the purification takes place, it is the psyche which is being purified all the time. You see? And with the complete purification of the psyche, there is a purification of the actual brain cells. There is some sort of mutation which takes place. And then mind, in its cosmic wholeness, functions through you as such, begins to function through you as such, but not till then. I have explained this in some detail in the latter part of The Heart of Religion. So, sees what should be seen. And that seeing, as we have tried to see, to understand, is something immensely profounder than what we mean by saying, I see. Kacchana goes on, he has become vision, become knowledge. Now I'll deal a little more with this tomorrow, but here I might just say, that which you see completely and truly, see with the eye of enlightenment. In mind and consciousness, now you have mind functioning through you. In mind and in the deeps of consciousness, you are completely at one with that which you see, that which is in your vision. And that means that you have become that which you see. You have become the vision. It is not something apart from you. You are the vision itself. In your own inner being, in your mind and consciousness. This is something which, as far as I'm aware, has not been adequately expounded through the centuries. But the hint is given, you'll find hints about this in Buddha Ghosha's Visuddhimagga, this business about mentality or mind and corporeality interacting with each other. And then Kacchana goes on, he has become Dhamma, become Brahma. Note very carefully the use of the word Brahma and Brahman throughout the Buddhist texts. It's used constantly by the Buddha himself. The whole of the last chapter of the Dhammapada is the Brahmana Vagga, and the meaning of the word Brahmana. And there, if you study that very carefully and study the Vajrasuchi Upanishad very carefully, you will see what a tremendous amount of influence the Upanishadic teachings exercised upon the Buddha. It is one of the sad things that conventional orthodox Buddhism has tended to cut itself adrift from its parent, which is Brahmanism after all. You can't get away from that fact. There's too much evidence in the Buddhist texts to show that that is so. But you must study the others too also very carefully. He is the propounder, the expounder, the bringer to the goal. And the goal is something which shines through the individual when he is utterly purified. That is how the Buddha brings the individual, the isolatively self-conscious individual, to the goal by teaching him to live that kind of life by which the ill effects, the supreme dukkha, of the self as something separate from the total ultimate reality is done away with, and the ultimate reality shines through him. Enlightenment shone through the Buddha. Siddhartha Gautama, it was not Siddhartha Gautama who possessed enlightenment. Through his utter purification in every way, the psyche and all his mental processes. Then, when love and wisdom were in complete harmony, there was the enlightened state, the fully enlightened state, which was the state of the Mahakaruna as well as the Mahaprajna. And that is, I mentioned the Vajrasuchi Upanishad. That is how a Brahman is described. Not that he was born of parents who belonged to a Brahman caste, so-called, but one who had realized the ultimate, the supreme truth, the supreme reality, had become the perfected Holy One. This is the very, very important point which we must always bear in mind, very carefully. The bringer to the goal, the giver of the deathless. Note very carefully. The Buddha, Siddhartha Gautama, himself died. Every one of his arhats, every one of the perfected holy ones in the history of the human race were born. They also suffered physical illness and disease and so forth, and they all died. The giver of the deathless, in which sense? What is this deathless? It's this mode of awareness, this utterly transmuted mode of awareness, mode of consciousness, the manner in which you are conscious of yourself, the world in which we live, and our relationship to it, and so forth. That is completely transformed, and your attentiveness has become so perfect that you are able to be in tune with the cosmic pulse of creation from split second to split second. You can't imagine it. You have to have some sort of, some extraordinary touch of experience about it. And then you'll realize what it implies. And that is the deathless state. Because when you are aware of this pulse of creation from split second to split second, where is death and where is birth? It is the complete changing of one state into another. In the lesser sense, in the supreme sense, it is creation in the sense in which the Kabbalah originally taught the meaning of creation. Something utterly new, non-repetitive, and so forth. So, that is implied in that statement of Kacchana. And Kacchana goes on to, and Tathagata, very nicely translated as wayfarer. He who has gone thus along the way and realized, reached the point where the supreme realization took place. And Kacchana goes on, that was the time, that is when these people were with the Buddha, when you should have questioned the Lord on this meaning so that you might have understood what the Lord explained to you. But they were perhaps diffident, like I am diffident in the presence of some great professor or whoever it may be, you see. I feel diffident and I don't question. So it's like that. We must go. So, he's the giver of the deathless. And the word Bhagwan means full of bounty to his worshippers. That is the common meaning. That is how it is commonly understood. But would it not be more complete and more wonderful to to regard Bhagwan as being full of bounty to all living things? Not only to living things, but even to inanimate things. Full of bounty to them. If we were full of bounty to everything and everybody, wouldn't we all naturally and spontaneously live ecologically? And if we lived ecologically, we'd be in complete harmony with nature. We would not plunder nature as we have done for centuries. We would hurt nothing in nature, living or, as we commonly say, non-living. Although in actuality there is no such thing as the non-living. Everything is alive. And modern science has come to that point. That everything, the entire cosmos, is a living organism. It's one of the wonderful things science has done for us in this very century, and that only within the last 15 or 20 years. The next word, arahato. The Buddha always refers to himself, and his monks also referred to him, as arahant. He didn't say anything more. There was no need to say anything more, actually. When the Buddha in the Ariyaparyesana Sutta, the autobiographical discourse, talks to the monks, he says that whilst I was still the Bodhisattva, and then he progressed and grew towards that stage where he became the fully enlightened one. You see, and then he called himself the Arahant. Therefore the word Arahant must have a meaning deeper than what we are accustomed to ascribe to it. One thing we must remember, there is no such thing as comparison in the realm of the transcendent. Where reality, where truth is concerned, there is no such thing as transcendence. There is no such thing as comparison. This angel is a greater angel than that one. No such nonsense. This is all human folly. How are you going to compare one bit of infinity with another bit? You cannot have a bit of infinity in the first instance. You see the absurdity of the human brain. You can't compare. And therefore, to say that, oh, I belong to this sect of Buddhism, he belongs to the lesser one. He's only a so-and-so, whatever the so-and-so may mean, is just an expression of one's own foolishness. And lack of good manners, I might add. You see? You simply cannot compare where the context of the infinite, the eternal, and the immortal is concerned. There is no such thing as comparison there. It is so. Its isness is absolute. And in that lies its complete perfection. And if we try to introduce comparison into that sphere, we are doing something which is ill, which is in fact devilish. So now, the Buddha always talks of himself as the Arahant. Now, see what that word Arahant implies. In the third volume of the Digha Nikaya, it's in the third volume, page 133. You will find the Buddha himself saying, the bhikkhu who is an arahant, who has destroyed the cankers, lived the life, done what was to be done, laid down the burden, won to the goal, burst the bonds of becoming, and is freed by the fullness of gnosis, knowledge, cannot transgress 9 standards. This is one aspect of the Arahant. A bhikkhu in whom the cankers are destroyed cannot deliberately take the life of any living thing, cannot with intention to steal take what is not freely given, cannot indulge in carnal intercourse. Actually, that third statement in its fullness implies is utterly free of all sensuous self-indulgence, of which carnal intercourse is just one element. There are so many other elements implied. Cannot intentionally tell a lie. Cannot enjoy pleasures from savings. Now, who has holidays? Cannot enjoy pleasures from savings as of yore, of old days, when a householder. A bhikkhu in whom the cankers are destroyed cannot go astray through desire, cannot go astray through hate, cannot go astray through delusion, cannot go astray through fear. The Arahant is somebody, isn't he? A very remarkable person, a perfected holy one. The psyche utterly purified. It also comes in the same passage comes in the Anguttara Nikaya in the fourth volume, page in the translation it's on page 370. I won't read because that is only a repetition of what I have already quoted, but I'd like to read another passage. The Buddha, speaking to the bhikkhus, talks about the word recluse. Now, we have our own special meaning of the word recluse in the English language. And of course, for us, a recluse is one who is cut away from other human beings, in the limited sense. This is what the Buddha says. Recluse, O monks, is a term for the Tathagata, the Arahant, wholly awakened. Brahmana, monks, is a term for the Tathagata. Now who can possibly honestly deny that the word Brahman for the Buddha really meant what the deep meaning of Brahman as presented in the Upanishads meant for the Brahmanical teachings? He says outright, Brahmana monks is a term for the Tathagata. Discoverer is a term for the Tathagata. Healer, stainless, pure, knower, freed is a term for the Tathagata, the Arahant, wholly awakened. These are all synonymous for the perfected Holy One. So we get a wider and a deeper understanding of the word Arahant in this context. So now we have dealt with the word Bhagava and with the word Arahant. Now in the Mahavagga, he talks about the Dhamma, is Dhamma, and Dhamma Lord is talked of by Kacchana. What does the Buddha say about this Dhamma? You remember after the enlightenment, when he, after the 49 days which he spent in various meditations and so on, he was disinclined to teach. And why was he disinclined to teach? This Dhamma, won by me, is deep, difficult to see, difficult to understand, peaceful. And what a sublime peace that is that he talks of. I'm sure some of you at least, if not all of you, have at some time or other been blessed with the gift, that gift of transcendence, when you suddenly knew what that silence and stillness means. That extraordinary peace which is perfect activity. peaceful, excellent. Now, one of the most important statements, beyond dialectic. It's been translated as beyond reason. I think Miss Horner has translated it as beyond reason. No, this is also Miss Horner's translation. But I have seen beyond reason put. Beyond dialectic, there's no arguing about it. You have gone right beyond the realm of argument because all your doubts have been resolved. You have really seen, really understood. You know this is so because in your inner consciousness, your whole mind and consciousness is one with that which you have, which has been realized. So it's beyond argument. Argument always implies that you start from a certain premise, from a certain assumption and preconception, maybe with certain prejudices and a certain bias. But neither prejudice, bias, preconception or assumption has any warrant where the supreme truth is concerned. That has to be borne in mind. So it is beyond dialectic. It's subtle. It's intelligent, intelligible to the learned. The word learned is perhaps not the best possible translation. It's intelligible to the one become wise. You see? Which is very different from being a learned man. We have literally nowadays thousands of very learned men and women strutting over the globe. I'm not using that word pejoratively, but we have thousands of them. But are they arahants? Have they seen into this truth, which is the Dhamma? But this is a creation delighting in sensual pleasure, delighted by sensual pleasure, rejoicing in it, so that for such a creation, this were a matter difficult to see. That is, now he defines what the Dhamma is, what it consists of. Causal uprising by way of cause. This too were a very difficult matter to see. That is to say, the calming of all the habitual tendencies. Oh, one could write a volume on just that point. The calming of all the habitual tendencies. When you meditate, look into the way your psyche works and how the bodily action follows the workings of the psyche. And you will find that the calming of those habitual tendencies is indeed a very difficult matter. The renunciation of all attachment, the destruction of craving, the entry into dispassion, stopping, and nirvana. Now that's a good place to stop for the present. So seeing that the Dhamma meant all these things, and seeing the state of the world, the Buddha felt that if he were to try to teach this, and the people would not understand, this would be a weariness to him. It would be a vexation to him. It's interesting that even the perfected Holy One could feel that. A weariness and a vexation, because the world is what it is. But then, you all know the story, how Brahma Sahampati. Now, Brahma Sahampati means the creator God. He's the representative of the Creator God. In actuality, in modern times, in our age, we can think of Brahma, the Creator God, or any Creator God in any of the religions, as that sort of cosmic energy, that creative energy which brings the whole cosmos into being. And when I use the term whole cosmos, I don't mean just all the galaxies, cosmos as known to the astronomer. But beyond the cosmos known to the astronomer, there are all the galaxies, if you like, in terms of mind as such. There are grades of consciousness and being which are totally unknown. They are not spoken of. In the religions of the world, except in very limited terms, the names given to the archangels, for instance, the Amishaspans in the Zarathustrian teachings and so forth, represent these grades of consciousness. But they are regarded by all the millions of people as beings, and then by the word being they mean beings after our fashion, only of a very exalted nature. That is not the case. That which is something so extraordinary, so marvelous, that if any one person were able to contact it all, he'd probably burst with the realization. So that Brahma Sahampati appears to him and pleads for the sake of mankind. And he points out to the Buddha, this is what happens in the Buddha's own consciousness, remember. There's no person like Brahma Sahampati who suddenly appears. In his own consciousness all this happens. This tremendous archetypal energy at work inside him. And the Buddha then agrees to teach, and he says those wonderful words, "Opened are the doors of the deathless for all who are ready to hear." Now, a little later, a man called Upaka comes along as the Buddha is going towards Kasi, which was the old name for Benares, the modern Benares, you see. He is going there in order to meet with the five bhikkhus who practiced very severe austerities with him. And of course he found that was useless, it didn't bring enlightenment. But they were still practicing away merrily, at least I expect merrily, in the deer park at Isipatana. Now Upaka, a naked ascetic, there were all sorts of crazy coots in India. And there are still today, you know. The human race is a funny creation altogether, who still practice all kinds of queer things, not very sensible things, believing that thereby they are being holy. Upaka came along, saw the Lord going along the high road between Gaya and the tree of awakening. Seeing him, he spoke thus to the Lord, "Your reverence, your sense organs are quite pure, your complexion very bright, very clear." People shouldn't go to beauty parlors. The holy life is quite sufficient to make you beautiful. "On account of whom have you, your reverence, gone forth? Or who is your teacher? Or whose Dhamma do you profess?" Now, the implication of this question, first and foremost, is that Upaka, by meeting a person, looking at him, was not capable of recognizing that person and what he actually was. All the world makes that error. Think of the thousands of people we pass by in the street, or who pass by us in the street when we are walking. We look at somebody. Who catches our eye? Who catches our attention? And we look and we wonder about that person. And we say certain things. Oh, that person seems to be... But that person may be something quite different what he seems to be to me. If I had the perfection of the enlightened one, when I see a person, I'd know the whole of him completely and utterly. It's not a question of what seems to me. What seems to me is usually quite wrong, because all my conditioning and my flaws and drawbacks are at work interpreting what I saw. So Upaka was one who didn't really see. When this had been said, the Lord addressed Upaka, the naked ascetic, in verses. Victorious over all, omniscient am I. Among all things undefiled, leaving all, that means renouncing all, through death of craving, freed through the death of craving, by knowing for myself, whom should I follow? You know, when we read these scriptures, we must read very, very carefully. Take plenty of time. Let the brain be quiet, the psyche be free of turmoil, as far as it is possible for one psyche to be free of turmoil, and see what those words reveal to us. The words will speak to us if we do that. That is real meditation. By knowing for myself, whom should I follow? For me, there is no teacher. One like me does not exist in the world with its devas. No one equals me. For I am perfected in the world. The teacher supreme am I. I alone am all awakened. Why does he say such things? Become cool am I, nirvana attained. To turn the Dhamma wheel, I go to Kasi's city, beating the drum of deathlessness in a world that's blind become. I alone am all awakened. There were all the great perfected holy ones, the Upanishadic teachers and others. Make no mistake about it. They were perfectly awakened ones, but they were dead by now. In his day, there had come about a certain degeneration and inadequate presentations of the Brahmanical teaching, the Upanishadic teaching. The most important defect was this. What was called the Atma by the pre-Buddhistic Upanishadic teachers was now a mannequin soul seated either in your heart or in your head, usually in your heart. And they talked of it as the size of a thumb, a mannequin soul seated in there. So you see, the tremendous mistake was made. My Atma. There is no such thing as my Atma. The Upanishadic teachers clearly declared the Atma, like the other word they used, Brahman, was the infinite, the eternal, the immortal, birthless, deathless, sorrowless, stainless. Now, I ask you, How different is that from what the Buddha himself sought and found, as he said in that Ariya Pariyesana Sutta? How different was it? Not at all. That was the original teaching. And it belongs, that sort of concept belongs to the context of the infinite. And as I have already said, you can't take the infinite and say, my Atma. When we say, my God, the God within me, we mistakenly think of the immanent God, as presented in religions like Christianity, is some special energy or power or something which is separate from the totality. It isn't. The totality functions through each and every one of us without our knowing it, all the time. And that which completely belongs to the context of the infinite and the eternal is everlastingly the infinite and the eternal. You can't say, my Atma, my God, my Brahman, or my soul, my immortal soul. It's a meaningless term. The psyche, usually, is the meaning of the word soul. That's what they mean. The mental processes, and so on. It's not mine. The Buddha himself teaches very, very clearly, this which is observable here in our existential state, every aspect of it, the body, the shape, the form, the feelings, the thoughts, the sankhara, the character pattern, and vijnana, discriminative consciousness itself, they are all perishing. Every one of them, the whole of the existential being absolutely perishes. And there is no separate, identifiable, super entity which can be said to be permanent in that living in that existential being. The totality permeates the existential being, but not a bit of totality. This is the great mistake which has been made through the ages. Thinking in terms of a bit of totality is mind. You see why the Buddha said, Ananda, the freedom from all grasping is deathlessness. We read these things, we hear these things, we trot them out in talks and lectures and whatnot, but we don't know what we are talking about. So, when he says, I alone am all awakened, he meant in his milieu, in his particular milieu, where the original teachings had already become debased within a century of the golden age of the Upanishads. It shows how quickly degeneration can take place. This is one of the meanings of jara in jara marana, decay and death. The teacher supreme am I, for I am perfected in the world. Now you know, when we, especially in the modern world and in the Western world, read that sort of thing, one's natural reaction may be, what a conceited man he was. Was he? A person who is utterly free of the isolative, separative sense, self-consciousness of himself as an existential being, if he is freed to that extent, he does not make conceited statements about the self. He cannot make them. This has to be understood in the deep context in which it was said. And then one sees that there are no statement of evidence of self-conceit at all, but it's a plain, straightforward statement of actual fact. This was the case. Then Upaka says, according to what you claim, Your Reverence, you ought to be victor of the unending, the immortal. Whatever is unending has never had a beginning. It means the absolute, the totality. And the Buddha says, like me, they are victors indeed who have won to destruction of the cankers. Vanquished by me are evil things. Therefore am I, Upaka, a victor. Really, every little deep thing in the scriptures of the world is marvelous, if only we could enter into it in the right way, in the best way. Now, we come to the last statement. Samma Sambuddhassa. Samma is often translated as right. Well, the best I can say of that translation, that it is not altogether wrong. Samma really means perfect. If you study carefully the Eightfold Way as presented by the Buddha, every element of that way is prefixed with the word Samma. And if you then study the details of the exposition of each of the aspects of the way, you'll have to do an enormous amount of study to go through it all. You will see that the word Samma in the religious context has only one meaning: perfection. Not right with a possibility of some little error here or there. Nothing of the sort. It's absolutely perfect. It is the perfect way. And in a sense it is rather comic that it's called the middle way, which people tend to interpret as I put my right arm through God's arm, God's left arm, and my left arm through the devil's right arm. You see? And therefore I tread the middle way between God and the devil. The fact of me as an existential being is that I am God and the devil, more the devil yet than God. But still, there we are, you see. It doesn't mean anything of the sort. It means the way of good sense to start with. Not common sense, as the world understands it, but true good sense, which comes into being when the psyche is purified and the sense functioning is all purified, and it's the way which goes to the zenith, upwards, ever upwards. When it reaches what is the zenith for that particular person, there is no zenith, there is no nadir, there is only the absolute all, the totality. That is why I often say, if you want to understand the deep things, if you have perplexities, doubts, and so on, start with the transcendent. Don't start with the existential, which is the perishing. The existential is like one's clothes. You put them off and you put them on and you take them off, you see. But the living body goes on, doesn't it? It's like that. Our existential being, the whole psychophysical being, is like that. Then I must just quote one or two things in connection with this term Samma Sambuddhassa. Sambuddhassa means the fully enlightened. Sambodhi is the complete wisdom, the perfect wisdom. I think most of you know that phrase. Whoso sees me sees the Dhamma. Whoso sees the Dhamma sees me. And that is that remarkable story when one of the bhikkhus is dying of illness, and he sends for the Buddha, and the Buddha consents to go in person on this occasion. He doesn't send Sariputta or Moggallana or somebody like that. He goes in person and he asks him, how are you getting on, and are you able to bear up with your pains? And he says, no, I am not able to, and so forth. And the Buddha knows that this body will now come to its death, you see. And so he goes through the usual procedure. Is body permanent? No, it is impermanent, Lord. Now, if it is impermanent, then is it well in the sense of the perfect good, or is it ill, dukkha? And of course the answer is dukkha, O Lord. Then is it wise to regard that which is dukkha as mine? This is myself, this am I. And the monk of course naturally replies, no Lord, it isn't wise. Therefore, get free of it. Now we may, you know, especially in the modern world, reading these accounts of how the Buddha deals with a sick, dying person, we may say, how inconsiderate. Here was this poor chap. And you know the whole argument which we would raise up. The Buddha was concerned with the supreme enlightenment, with the fulfillment of the true purpose of existence of all existential beings, the perishable being. The fulfillment being the complete riddance of selfness as such. And only in mind and consciousness can this be realized. There is no such thing as continuous living, and so forth. And these things are unimportant. So what the Buddha tried to do, especially with the influence of his personal presence, was so to influence that person's attention, his mode of awareness of existence, that it naturally ceased to grasp at body or psyche or any of the aspects of the psyche. If he did that and died, he fulfilled the purpose of his existence. This is the real way to look at it, I think. I don't know whether the teachers of Buddhism would agree with that, but that's how I see it. This is what he was after, you see. And wait a minute, I must find this place. The Buddha says, monks, if a monk should seize the hem of my garment and walk behind me step for step, yet if he be covetous in his desires, fierce in his longing, malevolent of heart, of mind corrupt, for mind, use the word psyche today, careless and unrestrained, not quieted but scatterbrained and uncontrolled in sense, that monk is far from me and I am far from him. What is the cause of that? Monks, that monk sees not Dhamma. Not seeing Dhamma, he sees not me. And he continues, even though a monk should dwell 100 yojanas away, and that was a very, very big distance in those days, the yojana was so many miles, yet if he be not covetous in his desires, not fierce in his longing, not malevolent of heart, not corrupt in psyche, but with mindfulness set up and composed, calm, one-pointed, and restrained in sense, then indeed that one is nigh unto me and I am nigh unto him. What is the cause of that? Monks, that monk sees Dhamma. Seeing Dhamma, he sees me. What an extraordinary explanation of what he himself is. He's the fully enlightened one, and he's completely identified with the Dhamma that he teaches. So that's the implication there. Then again, there is this which he says. Monks, I am a Brahman. Out of his own mouth, I am a Brahman, and no mistake about it. One to ask a favor of. Ever clean-handed, wearing my last body, incomparable physician and surgeon. You are my own true sons, born of my mouth, born of Dhamma, created by Dhamma, my spiritual heirs, not carnal heirs. Now this is a very interesting statement. You are my own true sons. This is another very important bit of evidence to show the influence not merely of the Upanishadic teachings, but of the Rig Veda itself. In the 10th book of the Rig Veda, hymn 90, verse 12, it is stated outright that the Brahman, the true Brahman, not just because he was born of a particular caste, the true Brahman was the son of Brahma. Born of his mouth, yes. The Brahman was born of his mouth, the Kshatriya was born of his arms, the Vaishya of his tummy, and the Shudra of his legs and feet. This is exactly the teaching in the Rig Veda also. And of course, Woodward has a footnote here in which he says, a probable reference to the claims of Brahmins to be born of Brahma's mouth. Can't understand a man as learned as Woodward. I knew him very well. He was a very nice man, very remarkable man. And he devoted his whole life towards these translations and so on. And he shouldn't have said a probable reference. He should have looked it up and said that it is definitely taken from the Rig Veda. So you see how the Buddha acknowledges some of the sources from which he derives his teaching and presentation. Now just one last quotation. This is from the Itivuttaka, the collection of sayings. Itivuttaka, Vuttaka means said. Iti, as it was said by the teacher himself. This was said by the exalted one, said by the Arahant. So I have heard. Monks, the world is fully comprehended by the wayfarer, the Tathagata. From the world, the wayfarer is released. The arising of the world is fully comprehended by the wayfarer. The rising of the world is abandoned by the wayfarer. The ending of the world is fully comprehended by the wayfarer. And the ending of the world is realized by the wayfarer. These are tremendous statements. Monks, the practice going to the ending of the world is fully comprehended by the Tathagata. The practice going to the ending of the world is made to become by the wayfarer. That's a very curious and very distinctive Pali phrase, made to become. We would in modern English perhaps say, the way has been brought into being because you or somebody has discovered the way and can show you what it is, you see. But it has been made to become. It is a reality existing now. Monks, whatsoever in the whole world, with the world of devas, maras, brahmas, together with a host of recluses and brahmins, of devas and mankind, is seen, heard, sensed, cognized, attained, searched into, pondered over by the mind, all that is fully comprehended by the wayfarer. This is all part of what he is as the Samma Sambuddhasa, the fully enlightened one. That is why he is called the wayfarer. Moreover, whatever the wayfarer utters, speaks and proclaims between the day of his enlightenment and the day on which he passes utterly away, all that is just so and not otherwise. Therefore is he called the wayfarer. Now this is rather a difficult point. If you read what the Buddha says about the cause of earthquakes, he gives 8 causes, you see. Well, you study them and see what you think of them. There is an earthquake when the bodhisattva in the Tushita heaven decides to come into incarnation. When he enters the womb of the lady chosen for his birth, there is an earthquake. Well, that's quite honestly, I think that's a little bit of my eye and Betty Martin. It could have some sort of significance. Metaphorically, when the Buddha nature within yourself is able to thrill in you for the first time, because every one of us has the Buddha nature just as much as every one of us has the Christ nature or Krishna nature in himself, you see. When it awakens and causes the first thrill, it's a birth. And if you ever experience that thrill, you will experience it like an earthquake. Completely upsets your ordinary way of life, your ordinary outlook on life, your ordinary beliefs and so on. Everything is just turned. You are sort of inside outed. That's what happens. There's a complete transformation. And your whole mode of awareness of existence undergoes a tremendous transformation. Think about this whenever you feel like it. Don't make yourself think about it, because that will be fruitless. But when something inside says, now then, what about this? And you think about it, you will discover all sorts of extraordinary things. So if earthquake means that sort of thing, well then those eight causes of earthquakes have very real meaning for you, because you are the world. After all, the whole world is embodied in each and every one of us. That way. But otherwise, I would say no. If you want to take it literally, it's sheer nonsense. Therefore is he called the world. Monks, as the wayfarer speaks, so he does. A very great lesson for us. Do we always do what we speak, what we say? As he does, so he speaks. That is why he's called the wayfarer. Monks, in the whole world, with all its creations, the wayfarer is conqueror, unconquered, all-seeing, omnipotent. What sort of meaning do we give to omnipotent? Rather a petty meaning, really. Magic, to do whatever one likes to do. That is precisely what the enlightened one doesn't do. There's no such thing as I do what I like to do in him. But that which is the perfect thing to be done immediately here and now. And when he says that omniscient am I, in which sense was he omniscient? He wasn't an encyclopedia, a walking encyclopedia. That knowledge is not the knowledge, not the wisdom he's talking of. But knowing how so to live that this fruition of perfect wisdom and of perfect love may emerge through that sort of living. And that is what Samma Sambuddhassa implies. There's so much one can talk about it, but I'm afraid you must forgive me, I'm a little bit exhausted now.